When you were a child, did you have to do stuff for the adults around you which made you feel used? Do you remember being made to feel awkward or embarrassed or even ashamed? Maybe it was something little, having to laugh at the stupid jokes of an irritating uncle, or dressing up in hideous frilly clothes for grandma. Perhaps it was something bigger, being pushed to perform on stage, or to play on a sports team, or to do something else that wasn't your love and which made you feel humiliated. Perhaps it was much worse, being made the subject of an adult's predatory sexual desires, or just being constantly pushed and shoved to meet the needs of the adults around you. I suspect that all of us have experienced some of this to some extent when we were children. And tonight we just heard about another child who is shaped by the desires of the adults. Mark's Gospel tells us that Herod's daughter is sent out like bait to dance for the king and his guests. And her dance is so charming, so alluring, according to our translation or transliteration, that she's promised whatever she wishes. With a drunken flourish, Herod says to her, "Up to half my kingdom," even though he's nothing more than a tin pot dictator under Rome's thumb, and has no power to give even an inch of his kingdom away. The girl goes back to her mother to confer, and she returns with a macabre request, the head of John the Baptizer on a platter. Poor Herod. The scriptures tell us that Herod knew John was a righteous and a holy man and that he protected him. But at the mercy of his scheming wife and daughter, Herod was compelled to execute John. At least this is how I've heard the passage interpreted. But I feel the need to exercise what's called a hermeneutics of suspicion here. Whenever women are portrayed as scheming, manipulative, bloodthirsty and irredeemable in a patriarchal text, I think it's worth looking a little more closely. So where is this story based? Well, it's based in King Herod's court. And we're talking about Herod here. Herod who ordered the slaughter of the innocents. Herod who, in utter contempt for the law and for God, married his brother's wife. Herod, who locked John up in a stinking hellhole of a jail for speaking the truth about his marriage. Herod, who drank too much and promised too much and chose to save face in front of his guests. Well, he's not really the victim here. So let's take a look at the daughter. The Greek word translated as daughter is kotosion. It's the diminutive form or the little form of a word kore, and kore means girl. It doesn't mean young woman, it means girl. And kotosion means little girl. She's a little girl. When we hear this story, and when we hear translations of this story, most of us picture a young woman dancing for the king and the powers that be and exercising her sexual power. But this story comes from an age when girls are married off before they hit puberty. And no married woman goes dancing for other men in this culture. We should be imagining a young, probably prepubescent girl. And now things get interesting. This is not a girl who's had much opportunity to decide her own actions or to shape her own destiny. She's been groomed from birth. She's been trained in ways which are pleasing. She learns to dance and how to wear nice clothes. She learns to speak when spoken to and not before, to compliment and to flatter. She's a keystone of her mother's plan to silence a vocal critic. Her virginity will be sold off to the highest bidder as her father arranges the most politically advantageous marriage he can negotiate. There is very, very little difference between her upbringing and that of a child raised for straight prostitution. It's just the stakes are higher. And this girl learned to perform her role really well. She maybe didn't feel a single twinge of resentment about her mother pushing her out there. She may not feel embarrassed by having to perform for her father and his guests. She probably feels quite proud. And yet in every step of this story, she's being used by the adults around her to incredibly destructive effect. And it raises questions about the ways that we all were used as children and the ways we all use children now, because this is what most adults do. As a parent, I'm certainly guilty. As much as I try not to, I feed off my daughters. I take pride in their appearance. I think it reflects well on me. I take pride in their behaviour because it shows that I'm a good mother. I take pride in their school reports because it vindicates choices I've made about their upbringing. I take pride in their wild adventures and their cheekiness because it proves that I'm not as staid as I'm afraid I am. In other words, lots of the emotions I feel about my children are actually about how I think my children reflect well on me. And when my children do something which deeply challenges my sense of self, then I'm tempted to push them away or to assign them to my husband's side of the family. They're your children, dear. And because my children are terrific and loving and responsive, they often try and fulfil my expectations. And that's not always a bad thing. We want and we expect our children to be thoughtful and loving and kind. It reflects well on me, but it's good for them too. But what matters is when we become like Herodias, looking to children to achieve our own goals, to feel good about ourselves and to justify our choices. There are many other ways that adults use children. We all know children who are played off between their parents. Perhaps a mother's seeking attention and she flatters her son to attract her husband again. Perhaps a family's split up and a father resents the level of child support that he has to pay. Rather than working out the best care arrangement for the child, he demands equal access to make sure that he pays less, even when he works long hours and is not able to look after the child himself. In other families, child support's never forthcoming, only expensive gifts given to play off parent against parent. As a nation, we sacrifice children all the time. Poorer children have been sacrificed in numerous ways by successive federal budgets. Children are locked up in immigration detention even now for political gain. We can afford our clothes and our coffee and our chocolate, because much of it's made by other people's children. And it all seems too hard to find things made without child labour, so we turn a blind eye. We all live in the shadow of a royal commission that's uncovering just how many children were exploited in the institutions that were supposed to protect them. And we live in a world where children's bodies are widely available for adult gratification, whether for viewing online or for physical encounters, often in other, much poorer countries. And as a mother, I can tell you the pornographication of the young is rampant. We see it expressed in all sorts of ways, in the sexy clothes available to children, in the ways young kids internalise the gaze of others, leading them to experience dissatisfaction with their bodies and their appearance. In the eating disorders and the anxiety and the depression that has erupted even among the very young. It's 2,000 years since this story was first told, and we're still feeding on our children. Now, we can wring our hands in despair, and I often do, but we can also make choices. We can place our trust in kings and petty despots, in prime ministers and presidents and the powers that be, the sort of people who make their daughters dance for their dinner guests or who stand them in virginal white on their prime ministerial platform, people who will deny even the youngest undocumented migrants the privilege of residency and who keep children in immigration detention camps. We can place our trust in the advertisers who tell us that our value is rooted in our physical appearance and our high status possessions, and who focus enormous efforts and billions of dollars on our children. We can place our trust in politicians and newspaper magnates and earthly kings and believe what they tell us and keep our heads down and maintain the status quo. Or we can place our trust in the heavenly king and claim our prophetic voice. This king condemns the way we use children for our own ends. Whoever causes any of these little ones who believes in me to stumble, it would be better, he says, that a heavy rock be tied around his neck and he be thrown into the sea. Whoever teaches Herod's daughter to use her gifts and her beauty for murder, it would be better for them that they be drowned. Whoever teaches a child to hate, whoever leads a child to stumble, whoever locks a child in detention, whoever abuses or exploits a child for their own gain. Well, Jesus has some pretty hard words for them and for us. And it's our job as a church to preach these words over and over again. But even as we exercise our prophetic voice, we also proclaim the good news. And the good news is that we too are children, and we've been adopted as children of the King. And unlike an earthly king, this king doesn't withhold his love until we comply. This king doesn't ask us to sing for our supper, or to smile for the cameras, or to keep our mouths shut. This king doesn't use us or abuse us, but he longs to bind up our wounds. This king doesn't ask us to endure the status quo. And in fact, if the status quo is damaging people and damaging children, then we might even be asked to question it, since this king has redeemed us to the praise of his glory. And in return, he asks that his glory be made manifest, not in words, but in lives overflowing with love and justice and mercy and peace, especially towards our children. So which powers will you place your trust in? Which king will you serve? One who wields power like a weapon and uses little ones to build his earthly kingdom? Or the one who gets down on his knees and washes your feet? The one who heals your wounds? The one who's adopted you into his family? The one who reaches out his hand and says, "You are loved. Come and join me at the feast."